Welcome to Lecture 19, October 25th, 2023. Lecture notes page is 161. So here we are up wandering around the last part of October. I suddenly sort of realized that in just over a week we do midterm two. So I thought I'd show that visually, although it doesn't quite fit together right. But after next week, we get into midterm two. I'll put up some reminder slides next week about that. But it's the same principle as midterm one was. So today we are noting that mini test 9 is open, up and running, and it will close Sunday. Somebody just wrote me an email about mini test 9, but it's still open, isn't it? We aren't at the 20th minute. It's fine. I'm confused about what they were writing. They wanted more chance. They wanted more time. Never mind. Anyhow, it's open. It's running till Sunday. Anyhow, Advanced Learning Extra Credit number 6 closes tonight at 11:59. 7 will open tomorrow. It'll cover new product development if you're doing the McGraw-Hill version. So Snickers, any Snickers fans? Snickers, couple Snickers fans. Snickers and NFL encourage fans to share their rookie mistakes in augmented reality. For the second year in a row, augmented reality company Blipar worked with the Mars Agency to bring an augmented reality experience to the Snickers and NFL Rookie Mistake campaign. So we're seeing a bit about technology and marketing. This year, shoppers can scan a QR code on specially marked Snickers bars, select Snickers ice cream bars, and in-store displays to load an augmented reality experience featuring Pittsburgh Steelers linebacker T.J. Watt, who sits inside a Miss Teller booth. So we're seeing the use of celebrities in advertising. We're getting consumer involvement with the brand with this AR opportunity. TJ will ask people to confess their rookie mistakes before giving them a fortune card that allows them to submit their mistake for a chance to win weekly prizes and a trip to Super Bowl 2024 in February in Las Vegas. So we have a little bit of a sales promotion going on in the marketing mix. Who knows what T.J. Watt's big rookie mistake was? Anybody know why this is a thing? Who knows T.J. Watt? Okay. You've heard of the Steelers. Okay. In his rookie season, apparently, my story is, his shoe gets pulled off during some play. He puts his shoe back on but forgets to tie his shoelace. In the next play, he's out there attempting to a block of plastic, he trips over his shoelace that he forgot to tie, falls down, the guy catches the pass and goes for a touchdown. So that's his big rookie mistake, according to what I understand. So he's encouraging you to tell your rookie mistake using this AR, augmented reality concept. And it looks a bit like this. Maybe it's not going to work. All right. It works in the office. Let's see if I can get it entered here. What? What? Go back. Go back, go back. Go back another one. Go back again. Hit the X. Thank you. Jesus. Well, also it's funnier if it works the way it's supposed to.
What's up, y'all? Wondering why NFL pro TJ Watt is in a fortune-telling booth? Because football's back, and so are your rookie mistakes. Like double dipping in that cheese dip at the tailgate? Gross. Well, now your mistakes can give you a chance to win prizes. Insert your coin to start. Your fortune awaits. Speak your most embarrassing rookie mistake. That rookie mistake was straight fire. Thank you. I foresee big things in the future, really big.
So it's a little more fun if you're actually doing the thing, but that's the principle of what you get if you hook up to the AR and make it work for you during the interaction. So Blipwire has teamed up with the Mars Agency to redefine the NFL game day experience for Snickers. Our augmented reality campaign with TJ Watt from the Pittsburgh Steelers is a touchdown for fans, bringing a new level of excitement and engagement to the football season. Nah, but anyhow, here we see them doing something in the consumer age, in the age of consumer experience, getting you involved, okay? We all know, how many people know Ultra Beauty? Yeah, okay. Why Ultra Beauty is piloting in-store sampling machines. This ties so nicely with our previous example about these in-store sampling things going on. Ultra Beauty is on that bandwagon. Ultra Beauty, the largest beauty retailer in the U.S., is prioritizing its loyalty program, personalization, and innovation. Now in the Bolingbrook, Illinois-based cosmetic chain is testing a new program that taps into all three areas. Ultra Beauty is partnering with SOS, a startup that provides digital vending machines of health and wellness products for a pilot program. The six-month deal includes the installation of SOS machines, doling out samples in the 10 Ultra locations in New York, Massachusetts, Florida, California, and Texas. So they're doing a test marketing of this new concept to see how it works for them. As part of the trial, Ultra advertisers will appear on digital touch screens on the front of each machine, while the 41 million members of the retailer's loyalty program, Ultimate Rewards, will be able to pick and choose samples from inside the machine. So we're getting consumers involved with this new vending idea. The program could lead to valuable data about what products and brands are resonating with customers as we observe what they choose. So a little marketing research. What's unique about the SOS sampling program is it allows us to provide more personalized product choices for our guests and better understand their individual interests and needs across categories. We're not just handing out free samples of something, they're getting to choose, we're seeing what they choose. She added that loyalty members and customers who sign up in stores can choose one complimentary sample in hair care, skin care, and cosmetics each week. From the choices, Ulta will be able to glean better data and insights about what customers want and serve them more tailored content and recommendations in the future. So use your loyalty card, they know who you are, they know what you're choosing. Helps us to understand consumers' needs, wants, and desires. Experts have hailed in-store sampling as a smart way to get new products directly into the hands of interested consumers. So a little bit about new product adoption, and we've heard about this being used in other stores as well. This was just fun. The product is not available in the States, but it's an interesting way to use humor to get people's attention for your product. A regular dad does Olympic-level gymnastics in FinTech's brand's Playful Ad. FinTech marketing, financial tech marketing, tends to be dry and product-focused. Nordic company Vips Mobile Pay breaks the mold with a new film celebrating its ease of use with an elaborate gymnastics routine. So we're trying to show how easy our product is to use, and we say that that adds value. The Makes Difficult Easy spot shows a group of parents watching their kids' gymnastics meet and dodging the responsibility of collecting money for their summer camp. One dad suggests using a mobile pay box, that's what the product is, before unexpectedly jumping onto the gym floor to start doing ribbon gymnastics. Set to a song, Heaven, his routine sees him leap into the bars and rings to raucous applause, finishing to see that the money from the rest of the group has arrived. So we're focusing on the product benefit, the ease of use, and a little bit of humor in advertising. See if you find it amusing.
So, who wants to collect money for the summer camp?
I could just make a mobile pay box.
It was only you and me.
not hysterical, but it's sort of funny. It sort of gets attention. And it is the theme on their website that what they do is making it very, very easy to pay and get paid. So a bit of fun. Mobile simplifies life and gives you a feeling of being on top of life. We try to execute on that feeling instead of explaining it. But what does that feeling look like? To us, it could easily look like a regular dad doing Olympic-level gymnastics. So that's their ad theme. The film is currently airing across TV, digital, social media, and cinemas in Denmark and Finland, and will roll out on the same channels in Norway later this year. So their media plan in another country to get attention. So there we go. Lecture notes, page 161, and chapter 10 in the textbook, page 307. I'm trying to come up with my clicker that I set down somewhere. Let's see. Play back the video and see where I set my clicker, would you? Oh, well. That's mildly amusing. So I've been overly enthused last time, and we were running out of time on these ideas of fads, and hopefully you related to some of these things. They came in for a while, and off they went. They were gone. So that's a short, quick product life cycle, which is what we had been talking about. And there's some other variations in terms of product life cycles. Some are the opposite of being short and quick, the opposite of fads. They seem to go on for a very, very long time. I can only assume eventually they will go away. But for example, what's your next plan for a refrigerator? What's going to replace your refrigerator? What do they have in Star Trek? A thing that makes stuff? No? Not a transponder? Doesn't matter. So what's the next thing that's going to replace a refrigerator? Something that just prints your food in 3D? It doesn't make sense, right? So we see that with a very, very long product life cycle. Coke. Classic Coke has been around for a very long time. It's dropped off in popularity, but he certainly hasn't gone away. So some things just have a very long product life cycle, the opposite of a fad. For many, many products, we would say that the product life cycle is getting shorter, shrinking up, because it's just really easy for companies to come up with Me Too products that look sort of like the one you came up with. And because if we're talking about anything in technology, we keep getting faster and faster technological advances. And it just means that, boom, before you know it, they've come up with the next edition, the next model. Competition has rolled out something different. So over time, we're seeing these product life cycles become shorter. Product life cycle can be affected by a variety of things. For example, it can be affected by the product category and how it is used. For example, do you guys know the product Retin-A? Is that something you've heard of, Retin-A? No? Retin-A, when it originally came out, it was really used just as a skin cleaner. It was used for acne prevention. And then they discovered in use that it was a wrinkle reduction product. Boom! Suddenly that product life cycle expanded as people began using it in this new area that it wasn't originally used for. So here's how to use Retin-A for wrinkles and why it works. Expanded the life cycle because suddenly it was being used in a new area. Or we can talk about differences in geographic areas, such that you can get an expansion as you move to a new area. So growth is slowing down in the US with KFC and McDonald's, but we've seen already that it's growing if you go to China. So it extends the product life cycle geographically, another way to stay in business and be successful. As we think about who is interested in our product at different stages of the product life cycle, we note that There are different types of consumers out there. We already alluded to the fact that there's a subset of people who are willing to spend $20,000 on that first flat screen TV, even knowing that over time it's going to drop down to $800. Willing to spend extra money on that electric car, even knowing over time it's probably going to be reduced cost. Those people are the innovators as a personality type. Innovators are venturesome. They're more highly educated than the general population. They use multiple sources of information to keep up on what's new. And that 2.5% of the population are those that jump on that bandwagon quickly. You'd want to understand who those are for your product category. Then we have the early adopters. As time goes on, these are leaders in a social setting. They have slightly above average education. They pay attention to what's going on and catch on a little after the innovators do as we begin to increase off that introduction stage. The early majority are more deliberate. They have lots of informal social contacts, and they're hanging back. They're not jumping on that first thing. But once the bandwagon gets going, they want on it. I want some too. So that's as we get into that growth stage. The late majority, these are people that are skeptical. Typically, they have below average social status. They hang back. They're not jumping on quick. They may wait till we get into the mature stage of the product life cycle. They're just in no hurry to take risks. And then you have the laggards. These folks are not economically sound. They have fear of debt. They pay attention not to new sources of information, but what their neighbors and their friends are doing. And they're going to wait way down that introduction curve. They're going to be the last one to adopt a new product. So you'd want to know for your product category, for your industry, who are these people? How do you reach them? What are the sources of information? How do you get them informed about your new product? If you are engaged in new products, you have to be able to manage it properly. So you have to be able to predict the shape and the timing of the product life cycle. Is this going to be a fad in and out? Is it going to have an extended introductory stage? How long is it going to be extended? Well, it takes time for your retailers to pick up your product, time to let consumers know about your product. And then, easier said than done, what stage are you in of the product life cycle? And you have to adapt your marketing mix to that stage. So you have to be attentive to see what's going on as you've rolled this product out over time. You also have an interesting question. Are you going to be a pioneer? Jump in, be the first in the marketplace with this new product idea? We actually touched on this idea before. What are some risks of being the pioneer with a brand new product? Yeah. Who knows for sure if anybody's going to like it? We put a lot of money into it. We developed the thing, so we have a lot of money sunk into it. Who knows if it's going to catch on or not? What might an advantage be to being the pioneer for a new product? Let's see if anybody else is on board. No competition, and if it's successful, who do people think of when they think of this new successful new product? Arguably, you. You were the first one there. Bam. So you have this issue of advantage, disadvantage. So iPhone, when Apple launched the iPhone, it revolutionized the mobile phone industry by combining a touchscreen interface with a sleek design, intuitive user experience, access to a wide range of third-party applications through the App Store, by being the first to bring such a compelling and user-friendly smartphone to the market. Apple gained a significant first-mover advantage, allowing Apple to establish a loyal customer base and secure a strong market position, which still carries on today. How many are Apple users? Apple? Look at those proud Apple heads. All right? So how did they get that position? They also have a good product. It's a little expensive. But they have a good product, and they've gotten that position. It worked well for them. Or an imitation strategy might be better. Advantages to the imitation strategy is you don't have to build up that product awareness. People know about it. You aren't taking that initial risk of initially developing that new product. You're looking to see what they're doing, and then you're coming on board later. issue is, of course, you're not the market leader. People may not associate you with that product category. If your marketing is really good, maybe they do pick up with you. So Friendster, founded in 2002, became the world's most prominent social network for a short time. It ultimately shut down in 2015. It was overtaken by Facebook. So for them, Facebook didn't have to be the pioneer. They were a follower. They're still doing okay for themselves, as far as I know. They're still out there. Facebook was a latecomer to the social networking market. They succeeded with controlled growth, reliable technology. They embraced consumers' wants. For example, they were allowed to have pet pages. And by having product flexibility, they were not the first mover. They waited. They saw what was going on. They came in later. They've done a good job. So it just depends on the situation. There's no one answer to how to make that work. So in terms of entry, are you a pioneer? Are you an imitator? Do you wait or not? In terms of in growth stages, well, video games were introduced in the 1970s. I think I still have that at home. In 1977, Atari released the Atari 2600, the most famous of the pre-Nintendo video game consoles. In the 1980s, Atari ruled the video game universe, but over time, poor quality control on its games and a lack of innovation helped other companies to gain market share, and it went out of business in 1992. You're good, you're growing, you've got leadership, and then you crash and burn because you don't do a good job with managing your product as it grows. Whoops. There went your advantage. There went your leadership. As you rise, of course, there's competition coming in. You have to differentiate your product from the competition. So what do we see? Well, Xbox 360, Sony PlayStation, Nintendo Wii. We see technological leapfrog with more video and audio and graphics while controlling prices as we challenge one another in the exciting video console field. Xbox users? Oh. PlayStation? Good group. Nintendo? Wow. Oh, wait. You raised your hand all three times. How many things you got? So these guys have done well in that area. During maturity, what are you going to do in the maturity stage of the product life cycle? Your product has been around a long time. People know what it is. Is there any excitement to be had? Well, of course, we did find some excitement when we saw Fred Hunt talking about what Sherwin-Williams did with their new innovative packaging design. It's still paint, but it's paint in a new package. A little excitement there in the maturity stage of the product life cycle. Dutch Boys Packaging Innovation offers paint in plastic containers with twist-off tops. It's easy to carry. It doesn't need a screwdriver to pry it open. It doesn't dribble when it's poured. It doesn't take a hammer to shut the lid down. A little excitement in a very mature product category. This may be the same ad we saw before if it comes up. Nope. Oh, it's just the, what is it? I don't know. It's just talking about the paint. Never mind. Not exciting. So that's what they did to try to gin up a little excitement in that stage of the product life cycle. Your product has been around. It's been successful. Things have moved on. You're going into decline. What are you going to do in the decline stage? Well, surviving the decline may be the greatest product life cycle challenge. Who knows what that can is? Anybody actually know the product? How do you know that product? Well, you were out in the Civil War. Now, how do you know what that is? Or what is it? It's sweet condensed milk. Condensed milk? What's condensed milk? Well, there you go. Condensed milk came out in the Civil War. We didn't have a lot of refrigeration then. So it's shelf-stable milk. It doesn't have to be refrigerated. We don't have a huge demand for shelf-stable milk, but it's still around. They've managed to stick around, not because you don't have to refrigerate it. That's not the issue, but because they found other good uses for it. So they've promoted it as a key product in making various treats, fudge, easily and throughout the year, tasty products, right? They're stretching that product life cycle down, but you don't need it as a shelf-stable milk. You use it for this particular candy product. During the client stages, what can firms do? Well, first of all, they can ensure that their marketing and their production programs are as efficient as they can possibly be, because you're not bringing in loads of money. You also don't have to spend a huge amount of money because competition is not too strong. You would prune any unprofitable sizes, any unprofitable models. Sure, that would decrease sales in the declining market, but it's going to increase your profits. You aren't carrying all those extra versions of the product, inventorying them, manufacturing them, etc. You could run out the product to squeeze out the final profits that are there. Huge sale, buy our product, it's going away soon. Or the hardest route to go is to find a way to revitalize it. Bring it back to life. Make it exciting again, if you can. But that can be hard to do, because there's a reason it's in decline. Technology, competition, consumer tastes change. Part of the product is what we call the brand. A brand is, we would say, a living business asset. It's the business strategy brought to life across all touch points, which, if properly managed, creates identification of the brand, differentiation from competition, and value for the consumer. So brand is important to your business. Here's somebody talking exactly about this point.
So if you do actually concentrate on understanding how your brand creates value for your organization, it can be very, very successful for you over time. Because these things don't happen in a heartbeat. Because you're dealing with people's emotions, their connections with you, how they feel about you, and you have to deliver, of course. So there we are in the age of value, and then during that period of time, something very interesting happened to the way that people see brands within the context of their organization. Increasingly, the brand becomes effectively the business strategy brought to life. And this is the way you have to think nowadays if you are ever going to achieve that holy grail of marketers right now, the seamless connected experience. Because unless the brand influences the behavior and actions of every part of your organization, there is no way you are ever going to be able to deliver that. So if you remember one thing from this, brand's a business strategy brought to life. Simple stuff. If you can encourage your organization to think like that, and if you think like that, and if you can encourage your colleagues in the rest of your organization to think like that, you will be successful. You will make a difference. But unfortunately, things have moved on again. So there we are, happily in the age of value, understanding our brand could create value. And then we approach this thing called the age of experience. This is where we are now. So this is real stuff. It's not just us making it up. It's based upon empirical information on the views of CEOs, CMOs, CTOs, and everyone else who's got a C at the front of their title. So we enter the age of experience, and who better to sort of demonstrate that than that? But the big thing that really happened, of course, was this. The power is shifting. People have said to me, and I'm sure they've said to you, and you may even said it yourself along the time, that the customer owns the brand. The customer doesn't own the brand. The customer dictates what the brand should be. Because they're the ones who have expectations. They're the ones who have beliefs about what they might experience when they come into contact with your organization. They don't own it. But they are a massive influence on it.
So the brand is your business strategy brought to life. It has to be infused across all elements of your organization. So everything is pulling together, remember my term, an integrated effort of the organization. And of course, the customer has to be the focus of it. They are going to have the needs, wants, desires, and expectations that they bring to the table, in part influenced by you. The word brand is a comprehensive term. It includes a lot of stuff. Brands are used both to identify the seller and to differentiate your product from the competition. Yell out any brand name that comes to mind. Yo. No one has a brand they've ever heard of. Nike. Apple. Reese, whatever. So these are brands. These are used to identify the seller. You know what you're getting from a Nike shoe, Reese's Pieces, and differentiate that brand from the competition. The brand name, which is what we just yelled out, are the words, the letters, the numbers that can be vocalized, that can be spoken, that can be said. Nike, Reese's Pieces, Apple. So brand name is the thing you can speak. Pier 1 Imports, Procter & Gamble, Nordstrom, Hugo Boss, Victoria's Secret, all brand names. Brand mark is a symbol or a design or a color or lettering that is identified with the brand but typically isn't spoken. What brand is that? Nike. Now, amusingly, since I'm using this as an example of a symbol, it actually can be vocalized because it has its own name. That's the Nike swoosh. That's a little funny. But in general, you see that that's a symbol, and of course, swoosh is not the brand name. What's that on the left? Firefox. Mercedes. Shell Oil. Apple. Pepsi. And what is that? The Guardians? Cleveland Guardians? No. They're a baseball team up in Cleveland, north of here. Yeah. And it can also include something called a word mark, where we now add together the color, the design, with written stuff. So, word mark here, Google, the color scheme and the letters, Coca-Cola in its well-known red script. Here we have Scribbles, Coffee Company, not as well-known as our friend on the right, which is, of course, Starbucks. These are often known as the logo, or in the case of the written stuff, logotype. So that's all part of your brand as well. And, of course, folks spend a lot of time thinking about how that should play out. Trademark is the legal protection of a brand. And you put a lot of money into your strategy. You put a lot of money into your brand. You thought about segmentation, targeting, positioning your brand. You want your brand image, your brand name, your brand mark to represent your brand. And now somebody else comes along and tries to use something that you're using. Whoops, wait a minute. No. So brands strive vigorously to protect their trademarks. Periodically, have you heard that Walt Disney will come in and pick on some poor kitty, what am I trying to say here? Baby center, nursery center, whatever, that has Disney characters on their wall without permission? If you don't defend your brand over time, the courts say other people can use it. You let them use it. So you aren't protecting it. Disney would not like to give up rights to its Disney characters, right? So companies protect it. Anybody know what this was? What those letters were? What was it? WWF, the World Wrestling Foundation. And is that what they are today? They are not. Why in the world are they no longer the World Wrestling Federation? Because the World Wildlife Foundation, also WWF, said, those are our letters identifying our brand. You can't use them. You wouldn't think that most people would confuse the thing on the left with the thing on the right. Yeah? But the court said, you are right. You have trademarked that. They can't use the letters WWF. They protected their brand. What did WWF become? WWE, World Wrestling Entertainment. We have protected our brand against competition. A little stretch for me, but I'm not a patent lawyer. Then WWF stands and WWE is different. In 2017, the Cavaliers introduced two new logos. It took 18 months to come up with the two logos, making sure they had the trademarks and the color schemes all set and all legal, along with it being appealing to the fans. Took 18 months. And then in 2022, They redid it again. So. Yes, yes, yes. X out. So they come up with their new logos over time to represent who they are. So leading brands are obviously ones that have done a good job with this, and you know who they are. Apple, Amazon, Samsung, Walmart, Google, Coke, Microsoft. You know these brands. They've done a good job promoting who they are. They brought their strategy to life. Now, what happens to brands as values shift in the environment, as consumer attitudes change over time? Sometimes you have to think about adjusting your brand. So in the era of Black Lives Matter and ethnic sensitivity, brands have had to adjust who they are, how they represent themselves, what their positioning is. Brands create identification, differentiation, and value, but what happens when social norms change? Brands need to adjust. Quaker Oats ended the Aunt Jemima breakfast brand. It's now Pearl Milling Company, Aunt Jemima referring back to the enslaved people during the age of slavery. Mars Inc. changed its Uncle Ben's name to Ben's Original. Dreyer's Ice Cream announced changing its marketing and the name of its Eskimo Pie brand after nearly 100 years, since the term Eskimo is now considered derogatory by the native people of the Arctic. It's now Eddie's Pie. So you got to protect it, but you also have to pay attention to what happens with the consumer around you, the changing norms. Cream of Wheat dropped the Black Chef from the package. Washington NFL team, formerly known as the Washington Redskins, is now the Washington Commanders. The Cleveland Indians have consulted with Native groups as the team changed its name for the first time since 1915 and are now the Cleveland Guardians. Most brands need to adapt to changing social norms. Some hang back. So Congra Brands' Mrs. Butterworth said it would undergo a brand review, but as the time I put this together, and I probably haven't gone out this month and checked it, but as the time I put this together, no changes had actually been made. So Mrs. Butterworth may still be out there as Mrs. Butterworth. How's it work for your consumers? How's it work for your brand? Seems like a lot of work. Seems like a lot of work to brand my product. Why bother? Why should I brand? Well, during the pandemic, there was a lot of supply chain issues, you know. You remember that. So my wife toddles off to the store and comes back with some English muffins, which the only thing they said on the package was new and improved. I said, what is this? Where's my, who knows a brand of English muffin? What's the brand, famous brand? Any brand? Yeah. Thomas's English Muffins, man, it's the brand. What did you bring back? And what is it new and improved of? I don't understand what their ploy is here, except was there anything available during the pandemic. So I guess I ate them, but I wasn't really thrilled. What brand is that? Ah, there we go. Now I'm on board. Thomas's English Muffins. So I didn't have much confidence in that first unnamed brand. So why do we brand? Well, for consumers, brands help us to identify the product or service. How would you like to go into a store and just buy a product called, I don't know, soup? There are different soups. They have different soup. Helps to assure consistent quality. If you buy Thomas's, you pretty much know what you're getting. If you buy new and improved, what are you getting? I don't know. Makes shopping easier and faster. Again, imagine going into a grocery store where things just said things like soup, bread, cereal, and you had to pick up each box and read it to see what it was, see what the ingredients were, see who manufactured it. What? Take you forever to do your shopping. There we have on the left, Apple Rick's cereal, an actual product, versus Fruit Loops. I feel like I know what I'm getting on the right-hand side. I'm not sure what I'm getting on the left-hand side. Here's generic tomato sauce. You can make something for your family at home. Let's just get some good old generic tomato sauce. I tell you what, give me Heinz, give me Campbell's. For sellers, brands provide a focus for their marketing, for their promotion, for their sales. So they aren't just advertising tomato sauce, they're advertising a particular brand, Ragu. They allow for recognition and differentiation. My cereal is different than your cereal. My soup is different than your soup. And because we now were able to build some value around our brand name, it reduces the importance of price comparisons. If it's just a shelf of soup, I don't know who's made it. I guess I've had the cheapest one. It's all soup. What's the difference? Campbell's soup versus Food Club. Give me the Campbell's, I'm sorry. So, reducing the importance of price comparisons, so they're able to get a little extra profit out of their differentiated brand. Are the benefits to branding worth the costs? Well, business thinks they are. Cody paid Procter & Gamble $12.5 billion to acquire Wella Hair Care, Clairol Hair Coloring, and CoverGirl Makeup Brands. Pretty sure if that was just called hair care, hair coloring, and makeup, it wouldn't be worth $12.5 billion. So yeah, we think that the benefits, as manifest in the real world, with purchases like this, are worth the cost. Interbrand, periodically, provides to us the best global brands. The things are not updated all the time, so this may not be, probably isn't this year's thing, because they probably haven't updated it yet, but let's see what they have to say about their best global brands.
Welcome back to Squawk Box. Big Tech dominating a new report on the most valuable global brands. Joining us right now to talk about all of this is Daniel Binns. He's the CEO of the New York office of Interbrand, which puts this list together every year. Before we get really deep on this, just the methodology that you pursue.
It's basically a threefold thing. So we look at the financial performance of the company and its future earnings. We then look at the role of brand, which is basically what we determine to be the amount of the customer decision making, which right. is built by brand versus functional attributes of the company. And then what we defined as, right. as the strength of the brand is that the companies that do well on the list are those that are endlessly responding to customer needs and therefore managing to stay relevant. And you know, it's tough because you know, the world is moving very fast. Customer expectation is moving faster than most companies can keep up. So the strongest brands are the ones that are able to transcend, make what we call an iconic move and sort of shift from the customer expectation.
So 26 of the 100 brands saw double-digit percent growth because of these responding to consumer needs. In general, in 2019, at least, tech brands dominated the list. And in that year, MasterCard grew faster than any other brand with a 25% increase in value. Consumer expectations move fast. You have to keep up with them as your brand to stay relevant. In Interbrand's best global brands of 2022, Apple held onto the number one position for the 10th consecutive year. Microsoft moved up into second place, overtaking Amazon. Microsoft, Tesla, Chanel saw the greatest year-over-year percentage growth, all increasing brand value by 32%. Good for them. So here is the top 20 in 2022. Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Samsung, Toyota, Coke, Mercedes-Benz, Disney, and Nike. All these are brands you know. All these are brands that you respect. They're all successful global brands, keeping up with consumers, providing value. If that's so important, well then, why aren't all products branded? Why do we have any unbranded products? Well, branding comes with responsibilities that some companies say, you know what? I don't need it. I don't care. I don't want to do that. I'll manufacture it, but I don't need it branded as well. Brands require expensive promotion. Costs a lot of money to build your name up as Crest White. Brands require maintenance of product quality. Some manufacturers don't care too much about that either. Branding does not make sense if the product cannot be physically differentiated from others. So we aren't going to brand our particular bushel of wheat, barley, or rye from the farmer down the road. You can't tell the difference there. My other example of clothespins, Again, somebody one day is going to tell me they have a favorite brand of clothespins, but in general, clothespins are clothespins. What brand do you like? It's not worth spending a lot of money on that. So sometimes you can't differentiate it from others. A good brand name, if you choose to do it, should actually, or could actually, contribute to the success of the product itself. For example, a replacement battery for your car battery that just died could be Diehard Battery. Wow, that sounds like something I want. Mine just died. I want one that it's hard to kill off. I want Diehard. Comes together. But the challenge to finding a good brand name that does what you want it to do is finding a good brand name. We're sort of running out of brand name possibilities because there are 30,000 or more products launched every year. There are only a limited number of words in the English language. How are you going to keep coming up with new brand names? It becomes a little tricky. At one point, I had up how many words there are in the entire Oxford Dictionary. It's not a huge number. So what do? Well, we come up with innovative stuff. We're marketers. For example, we'll combine words with numbers to create a brand name. 7-Up, 3M, Chanel No. 5, 7-Eleven, 9 Lives, WD-40, Phillips 66. We take a word, we add a number to it. That gives us a lot more options in terms of how to name our brand. One approach. A different approach is to come up with our own word. A word that's new or totally meaningless. Motorola Razr, Exxon. Exxon did a massive study internationally to make sure that their new brand name had no meaning anywhere in the world in any language at all. Plus, they have a little interesting double X idea. Novartis, Google, Skype, Lexus, all invented words, which now have meaning to you because, of course, we've paired these new words with things that you associate them with, the actual product. A good brand name should possibly suggest the benefits or use of the product. For example, if you want a new mattress, how about Simmons Beauty Rest Mattress? Ah, sounds like something I'd like. Or it would be good if it's easy to pronounce, to spell, to remember. When you think of laundry detergent, what one brand might leap to mind? Laundry detergent? Tide. Pretty simple, pretty easy, easy to spell, easy to say, easy to remember. Should be distinctive, stand out, be different. And that is my example of Exxon with that double X. Don't see too many product names that way. And of course, given what we've talked about, do your homework, get your legal beagles on this, make sure it's something that can be registered and legally protected. You're going to dump a lot of money into that brand name. Don't find out later on somebody else is using it and you can't use it anymore, or you can't protect it. It should be adaptable to product line additions, extensions, if that's one of your goals. How are you going to grow your brand in the future? What are you thinking about doing? Some brand names, and this may not be the company strategy, are a little hard to imagine how they're going to grow into a new area given their brand name. For example, Southwest Airlines. What else are they going to be given that brand name? A, seems like pretty much they're going to be an airline company. We know the product Virgin. We know they're a Virgin airline, right? However, Virgin is pretty well open to other sorts of things. We've got Virgin Records. We've got Virgin Media. We've got Virgin Mobile. We've got Virgin Money. We've got Virgin Games, Virgin Atlantic, Virgin Hotels, Virgin Holidays, Virgin Care. They have a brand name that they set up to be adaptable to any extension they want. Hi, David. David's going to talk to us. He's a brand name specialist. Go know there's an actual occupation that you can get into helping companies make brand names.
I'm David Plasek. I'm the founder and president of Lexicon Branding. Our company has come up with some of the world's most well-recognized names So there's an area of linguistics called sound symbolism, which really says the individual letters of the alphabet, the sound of those letters, evoke certain qualities. So Swiffer is a cleaning product. We said, well, what is the sound of cleaning products? We describe things as sweeping and swiping and mopping. So we started to mimic those sounds, and you go from sweep to swipe. That's not that attractive, so then we put an F on there, and then it becomes Swift. Then we look at legal situations and trademark clutter, and we put an E on it, and then finally we move to an ER.
Stop cleaning. Start Swiffering.
There are five types of names. There's real words. The next block over would be real words that stem from Greek, Latin, and Sanskrit. Then there's compressions, like taking a word and shrinking it down. Then there's constructed words. And then finally, coin solutions. The first thing we do is we try to understand what the story is. We are, as humans, hardwired for story. We don't have to describe it. We don't have to tell people what the product is. But we do have to tell people, hey, listen to us. BlackBerry is an interesting story. They had tried for a number of weeks to develop really what were descriptive names with things like Easy Mail and Pro Mail. They were rejected from a trademark standpoint. We did some research. What we noticed about email and messaging and texting was that people's blood pressure went up. Let's create some names that decrease it. We started pursuing things that relax you. Someone wrote strawberry for summer. Our head linguist, he wrote a little note saying, this is too slow, too long, and underneath it, he wrote blackberry. Coca-Cola's Dasani. Coke came to us under a lot of pressure. They weren't in the bottled water business. So we were able to identify between Mexico and Canada over 900 brands of bottled water. Most of them descriptive. Poland Springs, Aquafina, things like that. And so we had a tremendous trademark barrier to overcome because everyone is trying to be descriptive. Let's create a coin solution. We put S-A-N, the Latin root for health, right in the middle of the word, not in the beginning, because that would lead to sanitary and sanitation and things like that. And then we built letters around that, and now it's Dasani, right? So it's easy to pronounce, has a great pattern, ends with a nice slim I, because people drinking water want to be healthy. We're all about being distinctive, being memorable.
So they actually get into the details of how the word looks, how it sounds, whether or not you can protect it with a trademark. So they help companies to
I'm David Plasek.
To create their brand names. Having created it, you want to protect it. I suppose you know that there's a huge problem across industries with product counterfeiting. Intellectual property theft costs companies something like $600 billion annually and costs something like 1 million jobs in the US that go to pirated products. Examples, pirates often copy drugs and medicines, youch, by substituting other ingredients that are cheaper and untested. In many such instances, the ingredients are water or talcum powder. Maybe that's not very harmful if it's taken orally, but if you inject talcum powder into your bloodstream, it could kill you. Not good. Counterfeit washing powder, laundry detergent, can be harmful to skin. Counterfeit toys have been shown to harm children. Counterfeit automobile parts like brake pads, tires, and shock absorbers have led to failures and accidents. Not good stuff. It's a problem. So we see a variety of counterfeiting in a variety of product categories. Here we see the fake versus the real. Purse. Here we see fake versus real soy sauce. Some countries of the world are really serious about this counterfeit stuff. Others are less so. So in taking students into Switzerland, the Swiss are pretty okay with people just walking through. They don't stop you as you come across the border. At least they didn't when I was taking students over. So usually you get off the plane, you collect your stuff, you just suddenly you're in Switzerland. It's fun. One time I'm taking students over, and everybody's through except this one lady, and they've held her back. What is going on here? She had bought a new counterfeit luxury bag. I forget who it was. And it was pretty clear, Louis Vuitton, let's say. And it was pretty clear that it was counterfeit because on the plane over, it had already torn. The plastic had already torn. Louis Vuitton plastic doesn't tear. I mean, not even made out of plastic. And they held her up at the incoming thing because they're serious about counterfeit products. They said, look, we can either fine you 500 euros, that's a lot of money, and you can have your bag in the country, or you can take your stuff, dump it in this black plastic bag, and we'll keep your counterfeit bag. She chose the black plastic bag. They were really serious about protecting the rights of the designer. And so you want to be aware of this stuff. Counterfeit toys have been known to harm children. This is a counterfeit cancer drug. It was used for the treatment of anemia, for HIV, chemotherapy, and cancer. And this was information to the public on what to look for, how it was screwed up, how you could identify the counterfeit example. The World Health Organization estimates that as much as 10% of the world medicines aren't real. Hopefully we catch most of that in the US, but that just means it's problems elsewhere. Amazon has an interesting problem. They are, of course, they don't only sell their own products, they sell a boatload of products from third parties that they don't know, you know, have anything to do directly with. So Amazon finds out that there are a lot of third parties putting up fake goods, counterfeit goods in the name of other legitimate brands. By the way, when you go to Amazon and you buy a product, you think it's from Louis Vuitton and it comes and it rips, you say, what's going on with this brand, right? It's a problem. So brands aren't happy. So Amazon taking a new approach to its counterfeit problem by putting brands in control of expunging knockoff products on its site. Something called Project Zero lets the brands themselves delete fake listings themselves. So it helps protect the brand reputation, the image, their revenue.
For brands like yours, preventing customers from receiving counterfeits is a top priority. And protecting customers, brands, and sellers is incredibly important at Amazon. Amazon strictly prohibits the sale of counterfeit products, and our customers expect that when they make a purchase, either directly from Amazon or one of its millions of third-party sellers, they'll receive authentic products. That's why we launched Amazon Project Zero. By combining our advanced technology, machine learning, and innovation with your expert knowledge of your own intellectual property and products, we can work together with your brand to drive counterfeits to zero. Here's how it works. Once you join Project Zero, just provide trademarks, logos, and other key data points about your brand, and our automated protections scan billions of attempted listing updates every day to find and remove suspected counterfeits before they're added to our stores. These protections are continuously fed new information, so we constantly get better at automatically preventing and blocking potential counterfeit listings. And if you do spot a counterfeit listing, you'll have the unprecedented ability to remove it yourself immediately, without the need to contact us. These removals help our automated protections get smarter and stronger, too. Tens of thousands of brands are now enrolled in Project Zero, working with Amazon to eliminate counterfeits. To learn more, visit ProjectZero.com. Protect your brand with Amazon.
So they recognize the problem. They understand that their customers are unhappy getting ripped off counterfeit products. Their suppliers are unhappy when they supply counterfeit products. Let's see what we can do to help things out. Join Project Zero. In 2022, Amazon identified, seized, and destroyed more than 6 million counterfeit products. So it's working for them. What sorts of things are going on? Well, in 2022, U.S. Customs seized $2.9 billion in counterfeit goods nationwide. What's most counterfeited out there in 2022? Of course, it changes by year. Optical media like games, DVDs, and CDs. Labels and tag logos that are not attached to the product. So, you know, it's a label that says Yves Saint Laurent or Polo. Computers and accessories. Footwear. Medicines, we talked about, and personal care products. Pharmaceutical counterfeits are one of the riskiest items that flood the U.S. market, often using dangerous chemicals. Fortunately, we're catching some of it. Apparel and accessories, consumer electronics and parts, watches and jewelry. Hey, would you like a Rolex? I got one here for only $57. You're gonna love it. Or handbags and wallets. So These are issues and problems where we see folks ripping off the legitimate manufacturer. Unauthorized sales, of course, do threaten major brands. In this case, we aren't talking about a product that is counterfeit. We're talking about a legitimate product that's being sold through an unauthorized channel. So it's called the gray market, as opposed to, say, the black market. This is the alternative flow of branded products which have been diverted from authorized sales channels. So I intend to sell my product in the U.S. at full market value, whatever that is. It's $100. I know that people in India aren't going to be able to pay $100 for it. So I'm going to sell it there for $70. So I ship it off to a channel distribution. They're supposed to take it to India and sell it for $70. Instead, they turn it around and bring it here, and they sell it here for $70. Wait a minute, it's $100 here. What do you mean you're selling here for $70? That's not what the dealio was. So these unauthorized parties divert the authorized product and sell the products far below market price, but unknown to the customer, because they were intended for India in my example, they come without the support or the service or the warranties of the original manufacturer. I know from the serial number or whatever, part number, these were meant for India. I'm not supporting it. You didn't pay full price. This hurts the company's revenue on the one hand. What's the party, ladies? We good? Want to share? Shall I come up and look at the cat video or whatever it is? No? All right. So this hurts the company's revenue and profit and can threaten the company's reputation. What do you mean you're not covering my product? There is a global organization called the World Intellectual Properties Organization, which we used to visit in Geneva, Switzerland, and that's one of our student groups there, who actually tries to help governments and companies throughout the world protect their intellectual property. And if that was something that you were hot for, you can actually go on their site and do free training in the area of intellectual property. So we need to protect our brand name in a variety of ways, not just from being stolen as counterfeit product, but also from going generic. That is to say, no longer being able to use our brand name, protect our brand name, because everybody is using it. What do I mean by that? All of these names were once trademarked brands. Aspirin used to be a trademarked brand. Trampoline, thermos, linoleum, yo-yo, escalator, shredded wheat. All of these at one point in time were brand names. But over time, the companies didn't do what they needed to protect them. They fell into common use. They became generic names for the product. There goes your investment. So you would like not to have that happen for your brand name. How do you, what's the problem here? How does a brand name go generic? Well, since there is no simple generic word available, people just tend to use your brand name. What's another name for an escalator? A moving up and down staircase? I mean, what else are you going to call it? So people start calling the thing escalator. And pretty soon it falls into common usage. Or you promote it so well that your product is the only one that comes to mind. What do you call for when you need to blow your nose and you want a tissue? You say, give me a Kleenex. No, 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 that's a Kleenex tissue. Don't call it Kleenex. It's Kleenex tissue. Have you ever been at a restaurant and you ask for a Coke and they say, sorry, we have Pepsi products here? Have you ever had them tell you that? Why did they bother telling you that? Well, first, you should know what you're buying. But second of all, they've been told don't use the wrong product name here. Coke is Coke, Pepsi is Pepsi. You got to make sure you're using the right one. There's my Kleenex example. So how do you protect your name? Well, first of all, be sure that on your product you have the indicated trademark. A number of years ago, Kent came out with a new logo for a while, 2010. Celebrate Centennial, Kent State University, 1910 to 2010. And the original version did not have the little registered trademark symbol. It was registered, but they did not show that it was registered. That can be a problem. You say, who in the world is going to rip off Kent State University's name? We've actually found people selling Kent State University degrees in other countries. having the little R isn't going to stop it, but at least makes the point this is not a generic place. Use the brand name with the generic name. Kleenex tissue. Yeah, so always use it together. Dacron polyester. Always use your brand name with the other name. And of course, the ever popular approach that keeps many lawyers busy, sue when somebody is misusing your brand name. Sue their butts to show that you're serious about it. In the same domain as Amazon was saying, hey, pay attention to what's going online with your product, you might want to spend time, even if you're not on Amazon, focusing on what's going on in the internet in your name. So the internet has created lots of opportunities for parties to easily sell counterfeit goods, not necessarily just on Amazon. You need to pay attention to what's going on. For example, the Corporation Service Company, founded in 97, Name Protect assists its customers, which includes leading law firms, Fortune 500 companies, and other businesses worldwide in meeting the evolving challenges and protecting brand name assets in today's global economy. They were acquired by CSC. And let's see if our link is still a good one, or did they go away? Ah, they went away under that name. So there are companies out there that can help you to track on your what's going on in your brand name. How do you know? What's a signal that there are issues with that listing? Well, first of all, if your people check your product on the internet and see that it's being sold at prices that are below what's possible, I bet that's an issue that it's not your product. Or turning it around, if you're a consumer and you go online and you see a brand listed for far below what you expect it to be, you might be a little hinky about its source, yeah? Lack of good contact information on the website. They don't tell you how to ask for help, where the company's located, etc. Missing service and warranty information. You can't find anything about it. On the website, they don't accurately describe their own product. That's probably not the company. Products are sold on sites that are not registered to the seller. You're smart enough to watch and see where that website is, and is it a secure website, and does it look like a logical name? Is the brand name misspelled on the website? Yeah. And sites with unsecured transactions are all indicators that there's something hinky going on in the listing that you're looking at. Different channel members can think about branding in different ways. One thing to think about is the manufacturer, the producer, and how they think about branding. So one approach is you manufacture it and you put your name on it. So if you're a very large company, it's expensive to run brand names. If you're well-financed, if you're well-managed, you might very well want to manufacture this thing and put your name on it. Apple, Amazon. We might also brand fabricating parts. These are items that are added to the final product without any further processing. They're just popped into it. For example, you know the product Dolby, right? And you know that you can get a lot of products with Dolby sound inside. And in fact, you might actually buy a product because it says it has Dolby sound. It's branded, it's included in the final product. Here's Netflix adding Dolby Vision content to its LG G6 smartphone. And here's a set of headphones with Dolby inside. So they manufacture it, they brand it. In this case, the seller wants to develop a market preference for its branded parts or materials. Hey, buy headsets that have Dolby inside. It's a good strategy when the product is also a consumer good that's bought for replacement purposes. Here we have Delco batteries and lightning to USB cable. Or the item is a key part of the finished product. So Dolby sound, a key product within your, perhaps your phone or your headphone. So it works in those cases. We good? I wasn't watching your writing. Yeah. All right. Another channel member are the middlemen, the wholesalers, the retailers. We talk about this branding as private labeling. So private labeling involves selling products which a business makes under another company's brand. So I'm a manufacturer. Maybe I don't want to mess around with my own brand name, but I tell you what I'm going to do. If you want to pay for my product to be manufactured, I'll put your name on it. You worry about the branding. I don't have to promote it, etc. When I worked with Tappan Appliances, not around anymore, but that's not the main point of the story, they had excess capacity, so they would manufacture products in the Tappan name, and on the same product line to different specs, they then manufacture products for other appliance manufacturers. They didn't have their name on that product. For the business carrying these products, private labeling allows them to sell products they have no way of manufacturing themselves using their unique brand. I just don't have the capability to manufacture it, but I want my brand name on it. The hope is, in the retail store, that manufacturer brands will appeal to loyal customers, while the cost-conscious customer will buy the less expensive middlemen private label brands. For example, Vega Coffee. Anybody know Vega for any reason as a brand? So Vega Coffee. We built a model that breaks the rules. Better coffee from us to you. Meet your new favorite roast. Vega Coffee sells its product to ice cream manufacturers who use it in their coffee-flavored product. Doesn't say Vega. It says coffee-flavored. They have their own brand. They also sell coffee to these guys. Middlemen, wholesalers, retailers, may only carry the manufacturer's brand. They may not want the responsibility of branding. So I'm only going to carry Heinz and Procter & Gamble and Kraft products. I don't have to worry about branding myself. Or I might choose to carry both the manufacturer's brand and my own private label brand. Kroger's carries national brands, as you would guess, plus its own brands. They use a tiered private label marketing strategy. The Kroger private brand emphasizes no frills products at the lowest possible price. They have another private label brand called Simple Truth. It's focused on the organic market. And they have Private Selection, a premium brand. They don't manufacture them themselves. They buy these from other manufacturers. Okay, so I think I'm out of time. It's the end of our time together. Extra credit number, whatever is opening tomorrow, and whatever is closing tonight. See you next time.